Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is White Pearl Inversiones against Somuza.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Daniel McMahon. I represent the plaintiff's appellants in this case. This case involves a dispute over fees relating to what was, as my understanding, the largest publicly awarded contract in the history of the City of New York concerning street furniture.
Counsel, before we get into the merits, I'm worried about subject matter jurisdiction. Your brief says that White Pearl is an Uruguayan corporation, but it doesn't have any corporate identifiers. What is its full name?
Your Honor, my understanding is White Pearl Inversiones, a corporation organized under the laws of Uruguay.
That can't be its full name. Uruguay has three different kinds of corporations. They all have corporate identifiers after them. As far as I can make out, that's actually required by Uruguayan law, as it's required by U.S. law. I did a little search online, which suggests that its full name is White Pearl Inversiones Limitada LLC. And if that's what it is, for the purpose of American law, it's a partnership, not a corporation. Now, there are three, as I say, three corporate possibilities, but it seems to me that the name you've given with no corporate identifier is the one thing that it can't be. So I repeat my question. What is your client?
Your Honor, I gave you what my understanding was. The case we originally filed was in the Circuit Court of Cook County. It was removed to the District Court.
Yeah, well, I will be asking the defendant this same question because they must have some belief about what it is to have removed it.
I would ask leave of this court with counsel to supplement on the jurisdictional issue. We would certainly, Your Honor, get the answer to that question, which this court must have, of course.
Indeed.
On the issue of subject matter jurisdiction. I do believe, and of course this would be subject to my verification, that to the extent that it is a partnership, all the principles are individuals and citizens of a South American country, either Brazil or Uruguay.
Mm-hmm.
But I would ask this court for leave to supplement on that jurisdictional issue as a threshold question.
Mm-hmm. We'll give the parties 7 days to file supplemental memos about subject matter jurisdiction.
Thank you, Your Honor. To get to the merits, Your Honor, I've referred some time for a rebuttal. I'd like to just touch on, if I may, two or three main points.
Here's what I'd like you to start with, because the master agreement says if the parties enter into an agreement for services to be performed in connection with a particular RFP, then the percentage is owed. There was no such agreement.
Right.
I mean, that's the big problem I have, trying to get over the hurdle of showing that there was really an agreement.
I think, Your Honor, to ascertain that it's our position that the March 25th letter agreement is the operative RFP agreement. It says itself it is an RFP agreement. The document says it's concerning request for a proposal by the City of New York, Department of Transportation for the design, manufacture, installation, leasing, and management of street furniture. It goes on to read this letter. It's a letter agreement signed by both parties. This letter sets forth the understanding and agreement between Somuza and White Pearl in respect to certain matters relating to the request for proposal by the City of New York Department of Transportation. The document itself says it is an RFP agreement. And the only issue here is that the master consulting agreement was actually executed 6 days later. It was being drafted. It wasn't created in that interim. The parties specifically contemplated the existence of that master consulting agreement at the time they entered into the letter agreement on March 25th, because they recognized and acknowledged it itself in the terms of the letter agreement. The letter agreement itself refers to the master consulting agreement, and I would ask the court to take a look at that exhibit specifically. It's at, I believe, the record at 62-1 at page 1. The letter agreement actually originally was written that the master consulting agreement is already executed. It referred to the master consulting agreement executed on date. That's crossed off, and it's put to be executed. The document had not yet been completed on the date that the letter agreement was signed. So they went forward. They signed the letter agreement. The master consulting agreement was done almost contemporaneous, within days of that document being prepared. So the two documents were created. They reflected the party's intent at the time the contract was entered into. They are integrated documents that refer to each other. The letter agreement refers to the master consulting agreement specifically by its terms and mentions specifically the issue of compensation that would be reflected in that master consulting agreement. The master consulting agreement refers to RFP agreements. And the document, the only RFP agreement that exists, is the letter agreement that specifically refers to itself as an RFP agreement. I think it's worth noting that both the district court and the defendant kept referring to it as a pre-RFP agreement. That's a term that appears nowhere in the record. It's not in the documents. It's not in any of the contracts. And I would add that the contracts were drafted by Samusa. If, in fact, they believe...
Counsel,
yes,
what turns on this? The compensation clause in this contract says the fee is $240,000 or any greater amount to be specified in an agreement to be negotiated later. It turns out there was an agreement negotiated later, but it wasn't in force at the time that New York requested proposals, and that suggests that the amount of compensation is $240,000. I mean, what's, you know, it's like this children's story. What's wrong with this picture?
I think the difficulty here, Your Honor, and this is the district court's error, was we have alleged the facts that surround the circumstances of the parties entering into this arrangement. Those facts indicate that these were done contemporaneous with each other. There was activity that was performed. My clients incurred out-of-pocket expenses that twice the amount of the base fee that's contemplated in the letter agreement. That's their out-of-pocket expenses. That doesn't include their time and effort for what they put in to assist with this process.
You're not addressing my question. My question has to do with the language of these contracts, not with what your client did later.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, the language of the contracts certainly is a factor to look at. These are hardly, Your Honor, unambiguous documents. If they do not contain what the defendants claim they refer to, they do not say pre-RFP. The documents don't say this New York City RFP agreement of March 25 terminates if an RFP is issued by the City of New York. It's an open-ended document that contemplates the full activity that was performed by my clients even after the RFP was issued by the City of New York.
But the master agreement requires a percentage compensation to the plaintiffs only if Sir Musa and the consultants enter into an agreement for services to be performed in connection with a particular RFP. And there was no particular RFP.
Our position, Your Honor, is
at that time, a
reasonable interpretation of the documents and the facts that surround the circumstances of entering into this contract, it is reasonable to conclude that the New York City RFP document, dated March 25, is the RFP agreement. And it makes no sense for these parties to go and create another document that's going to contain the exact same terms after my clients have already performed.
This termination by Sir Musa means nothing? I mean, what's the significance of that? Because they terminated the agreement before the particular RFP issued.
Right. The master consulting agreement specifically provides that it can be terminated, but that termination would not be effective as to any current arrangements on our pending RFPs. And this is a situation where these parties knew New York was issuing the RFP. It had been issued before. It was a reissuance of the RFP. They fully anticipated it was going to happen. They engaged my clients to perform certain services to prepare them for that RFP, and my clients' services were successful. They were awarded the bid. And certainly, Your Honor, my clients who performed those valuable services, and it's their position that this award would never have been given to Samusa but for their activity, they certainly didn't contract for nothing, zero. That's ultimately what the defendant's position is. Your compensation is a goose egg. In fact,
no,
it's less.
No, their position is your compensation, your client's compensation is $240,000, the lesser of the two amounts specified in the contract, which is $240,000 or a greater amount provided in a later agreement.
And the greater amount is provided in the later agreement, which is executed and signed, and which by its very
terms
cannot be terminated.
And which was canceled. Now,
right.
On your view, which state's law governs?
There is a choice of law provision in the master consulting agreement for New York state law.
That is, of course, the canceled contract. Which state's law governs this initial contract?
To the extent that the document, there is a choice of law provision in the letter agreement for the law of Spain. It's our position that provision was superseded by the choice of law provision from the master consulting agreement that indicated that the law of New York would apply to the interpretation of the contracts. On the issue of quantum merit, it's our position that is going to be the subject of Illinois law or New York law, but it's the same substantive law.
And why not Spanish law?
My position is that the choice of law provision in the master consulting agreement ultimately trumped that.
But that contract is gone. It was canceled, right? You're left with this initial document. This initial document specifies the law of Spain. What does the law of Spain provide for quantum merit or unjust enrichment recovery, which is your alternative to what's provided in the document?
I cannot answer
that. Maybe it's just forfeited because you haven't discussed it.
I hope that's not the case, Your Honor. Our position is that the master consulting agreement has a choice of law provision that controls the interpretation of the contracts. They are integrated contracts. The letter agreement refers to the ultimate master consulting agreement and vice versa. And with that choice of law provision, the law of New York would apply. On the issue of quantum merit, I would just add, Your Honors, and I see I'm cutting into my rebuttal time, setting aside the issue of whether or not a contract existed, if there was no contract, then certainly we have stated a valid claim and we've set forth facts for a plausible claim for quantum merit. And the district court summarily rejected the quantum merit counts, stating that because the services were not done pursuant to a valid RFP agreement, quantum merit and the equitable relief is not available. And that's exactly the situation that quantum merit contemplates, that if there is not a valid enforceable contract, the court can exercise its equity powers and do what's fair. And here in this instance, my clients incurred out-of-pocket expenses, significant time, contributed to the ultimate success for Samusa, and Samusa's position that they have to eat their $440,000 of out-of-pocket expenses, receive zero compensation for their time, and they basically walk away with a goose egg on the deal. There are no further questions for me, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. McMahon.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please don't touch the microphone. Mr. Dannon.
Sam Dannon.
Well, let me begin with you where I began with Mr. McMahon. You're the proponent of federal jurisdiction in this case. Why is there subject matter jurisdiction?
Your Honor, we removed this case based on our understanding of the parties and the citizenship of the parties. My clients.
Okay, so what kind of corporation is White Pearl?
Your Honor, we went with what we understood, which was White Pearl was a corporation that was an Uruguayan corporation.
There are three different kinds of corporations in Uruguay. I think two of them probably map onto U.S. corporations. One of them, which Uruguayan law calls a corporation, probably maps onto LLC in American practice and therefore is treated as partnership. Which kind of corporation, which kind of entity is White Pearl? You had to have answered that question before you could remove.
Your Honor, when we removed based on White Pearl being an Uruguayan corporation.
Uruguay is a civil law country. I mean, the question is, for jurisdictional purposes, is whether this entity is a corporation as U.S. law understands it. Right? The fact that Uruguay may apply that name to things we call corporations, limited liability companies, business trusts. I think there's one in Uruguay that maps onto business trusts, and limited partnerships. doesn't mean that something that's effectively a business trust or an LLC is a corporation for diversity purposes. When you've got something from a completely different legal system, and a civil law system is different, we need to pin these things down.
We relied on the allegations of the complaint, Your Honor, and our understanding, at least from my client, is that White Pearl is, if it is an LLC, it's an individual, and that individual is an Uruguayan citizen, and that's how they dealt with that individual. We will be able to provide the court.
We need the full details. We need to know his full name. We need to know its exact legal status under Uruguayan law. And then we are going to need legal research on the question whether an entity of that legal status is treated as a corporation for purposes of 1332A.
And we will provide the court with that supplemental briefing, Your Honor.
Okay.
As it's in the papers and as described, my client Samusa.
And oh, if by the way, you conclude that this looks more like an LLC or a limited partnership or a business trust, we need to know the citizenship of all of the investors. And if any of those investors is itself a partnership, an LLC or a business trust, we need to know the citizenship through as many levels as there are.
We got that, Your Honor. We will endeavor to get that to the court.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honor, our position is that the clear and unambiguous language of these contracts, the only two contracts that these parties entered, the March 25th, 2003 contract, which is the pre-RFP agreement because it was signed in anticipation of the issuance of an RFP, and the master consulting agreement, which was executed in April of 2004.
Well, let's suppose that's right. The law of most states, Illinois and New York is a good example, is that if you cancel a business contract strategically, you may have to pay. I mean, take the simple case, which all lawyers ought to be aware of. You sign a retainer agreement with your client, and the agreement provides for, say, 30% of any eventual recovery. And the day before the court awards a recovery, the client raises his hand and says, "You're fired." So what does the lawyer get under those circumstances? Nothing? That seems to be your view. Or a quantum merit recovery, which I think is the view of New York and Illinois.
Well, Your Honor, it's just not the situation that occurred along these lines. There was one contract that dealt with the services that the plaintiffs provided. In fact, even in their allegations in paragraph 62 and in paragraphs 129 of their complaint, they alleged that the services they provided were under the March 25, 2003 contract, which provided for a specific compensation of $240,000, which they received. So they received the money that they were entitled to under that agreement. The second agreement was the master consulting agreement, which was terminated under its own terms. It had a termination provision that said...
Counsel, that's why I raise the legal retainer agreement, because every client is privileged to fire his lawyer for any or no reason, right? Every legal services contract has got that termination clause. And we know from, say, Illinois and New York law that if the client exercises that, the lawyer still gets paid. Right, and it's the same thing, by the way, in a real estate contract. If the real estate broker works hard for a year to get a client lined up for a building, and the day before the closing, the client fires the broker, which the contract allows, the client still has to pay the broker. The question is whether this, as a matter of Illinois or New York or Spanish law, isn't like that situation.
It's not for the additional reason, the fact that there was no RFP agreement as provided under paragraph 4 of the master consulting agreement, so that there was no obligations or accruing under that contract that was terminated. There was no RFP pending. There was no allegations that there was anything done to hold off the RFP or do anything untoward with that execution. So if you follow the chronology of what occurred is they executed a contract in 2003 which dealt with issue services leading up to the issuance of an RFP. That provided for $240,000 in compensation, which they received. Then they executed a master consulting agreement, which dealt with not just New York, by the way. It dealt with many municipalities and how the parties would transact. That agreement under paragraphs 3, 4, and 5 dictated how these parties would then enter into agreements that would pertain specifically to the RFPs in question. So in this case, if New York had issued an RFP and then that RFP had been given to my client Samusa under paragraph 3 of the master consulting agreement, and Samusa would have then decided to proceed to respond, then under paragraph 4, the parties would then enter into a separate agreement pertaining to that specific clause. Reading paragraph 4, you have to give meaning to the word separate RFP agreement and that it would deal with a specific RFP, in this case, New York. So at the time of the termination, which then goes to the hypothetical or the analogy, at the time of the termination, there is no RFP agreement between the parties. There is no agreement that was created under this RFP, and under the master consulting agreement that dealt with the issuance of a New York RFP. Also at that time, New York had not issued an RFP. So there was no pending or strategic or viable vested interest at that point in time. Now, I will say too that there's an exhibit to this complaint, which is one of the letters, which even indicated that earlier in February, the parties had, or Samusa had advised, that they were going to cancel the master consulting agreement. So I think that the key there is that when this is canceled, there is no RFP issued by New York, nor do the parties know the precise date and time that the RFP was going to be issued. They had entered into a contract in March of 2003, where they indicate that the city of New York is going to issue an RFP. So there has been a long period of time where they have anticipated that this RFP is going to be issued. More importantly, under the master consulting agreement, no RFP agreement had been created, no separate agreement which was required under paragraph 4 and which would then vest or give any rights to the other side had that been created. That's exactly what the district court found. The district court, in analyzing these contracts and in analyzing this case twice dismissed the case, reading the two agreements and reading the only agreements that the parties had between them and reading how they interacted and how they worked.
By the way, what does Spanish law provide for quantum merit recoveries?
Your Honor, I'm not prepared to answer that as far as quantum merit under Spanish law. We have argued, and what we argued before the court was that contract interpretation principles, which were under Illinois, the court that it was pending, would apply in applying the clear and unambiguous language of these contracts and using the four corners rule to interpret those contracts. As far as quantum merit, we believe that quantum merit falls out because of the contracts and the interpretation of those contracts. As Judge Anderson in the district court found, there is no quantum merit or no unjust enrichment in this case because the plaintiffs have received the benefit of their bargain, which was the $240,000. I go back to the allegations of paragraph 62 of the complaint where they say they performed those services and continue to perform services based on the 2003 agreement. So they received what they bargained for in that 2003 agreement, the $240,000, and they cannot use quantum merit or unjust enrichment in order to improve the compensation position of their fully integrated contract, which was executed in 2003. And that's why the fact that there's no RFP agreement is determinative of unjust enrichment and quantum merit as determined by the district court. Because in interpreting the contracts, there was a valid contract, which was the 2003 contract, and that contract provided for $240,000, which they were paid. And then secondly, there was a master consulting agreement contract, which was also a contract up to the point that it was terminated. So in interpreting those two terms, you can't now inject unjust enrichment to somehow change the reformation.
If you think back to the question I've been asking, It sounds like you would say that Illinois law couldn't possibly provide the real estate broker any remedy because the real estate broker had an actual contract providing that X percent would be paid on the sale, on the closing of the sale. The real estate broker was fired the day before the sale closed, and therefore Illinois law couldn't possibly provide the real estate broker a remedy. But we know Illinois law does provide the real estate broker a remedy, and we come back to my question why this case is different. And it can't be different because here there was a contract that got canceled, because my whole premise of that line of cases in Illinois was there was a contract that got canceled.
And just to clarify, I'm not saying that in that situation the real estate broker would not have a remedy under the agreement or some other form. I'm saying
no. What Illinois law says is the real estate broker has a remedy under principles of quantum merit, not under the agreement.
Well, and what the case law would hold is that you can't use unjust enrichment when you have an agreement in place.
Well, you're just disagreeing with, it seems to me, Illinois cases on both real estate brokers and lawyers. Now, maybe there's some difference, but the cases I put to you specified that there was a retainer agreement with the lawyer. There is a real estate contract with the broker. And by the way, this same principle applies to commission salesmen. Right? A salesman with a company will often have a commission that's due on the closing of the sale. The salesman is fired the day before the commission vests. What does he get? Your answer would be nothing. There was a contract, and he was not employed on the day the sale closed. Illinois law, however, would provide him a remedy. And that's what I'm trying to figure out, whether there's some meaningful difference between those lines of cases and this situation.
And I think the meaningful difference is what these parties had and what these parties did. So the contract that was terminated, and the way I'm looking, is the master consulting agreement. And the contract that was complied with and paid for was the 2003 agreement. Under that 2003 agreement, they were performing services from 2003 and beyond, and that's what they allege. We performed services from 2003 and beyond under that agreement, and they were compensated for those services with the $240,000. Then there's a second agreement, which is the master consulting agreement. That's the agreement that's terminated on February 17th of 2004. And at the time that that's terminated, there is no separate and independent RFP agreement which would have yielded or vested a right to collect compensation based on the provisions of that agreement. Because the conditions preceding of that master consulting agreement, the conditions preceding that are stated in paragraphs 3, 4, and 5, did not occur, and in fact could not have occurred, because the New York City had not yet issued its RFP. So because no rights had vested under that agreement at the time that it was terminated, that's why I believe that's a different factual pattern, and it's different than what occurs in the example of that you had suggested with a commission or a brokerage or a real estate broker, which would be terminated right on the eve of the closing, let's say, because they've already vested or they had an agreement that vested. And that would be the distinction in this case. I would also say that as far as quantum merit and unjust enrichment, that what part of what the district court looked at, too, was whether the plaintiffs could actually rely on any of these statements or representation, or whether there was any firm agreement or acceptance by SAMHSA of any of these services beyond the 2003 agreement. So if all these services, as alleged in the complaint, were part of the 2003 agreement and paid for, and if you even accept that some of these allegations go beyond that, then you're still left with the fact that SAMHSA never accepted those services because at best they hadn't entered into a new RFP, which is separate RFP, or they had not agreed to a subsequent agreement and thereby accepted the services that were provided. Your Honor, at the end of the day, plaintiff's claims here fail based on the unambiguous language of the contracts that existed between these two parties. There is no dispute that there were only these two contracts, and their attempt to try to make an agreement that was signed in 2003 be the actual RFP agreement that would be entered into separately pursuant to paragraph 4 of the master consulting agreement, as Judge Anderson found, just doesn't hold water. It can't happen because of the chronology events and the factual pattern, which is that New York issued an RFP in 2004, which was one of the conditions preceding to an RFP agreement under paragraph 4 existing. You can't have an agreement in 2003 fit the mold and comply with those conditions preceding. The district court considered these contracts twice and twice dismissed it. Bottom line, there was no separate RFP agreement under paragraph 4. You got to give meaning to the word separate and respective to an RFP. There was no agreement to pay the plaintiffs the percentage compensation they seek, and as a result, the order dismissing this complaint should be affirmed. And with that, Your Honor, if you don't have any other questions, I will retire.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Dana. Anything further, Mr. McMahon?
I'd like to clarify, I do think I misspoke during my argument. I had it backwards. The master consulting agreement's choice of law provision is Illinois. The settlement agreement, what we refer to as a settlement agreement, has the choice of law provision for New York. As we indicated in our brief, it's our position that on the equitable claims, the proper law to apply is New York law, and we cited to a case for that proposition since the benefit conferred to Samusa was in New York. The issue of under New York or Illinois law, Your Honor, hit the nail right on the head. Given the facts that were pled, the plaintiffs are entitled to relief under the quantum merit and equitable theories that have been asserted. I would just highlight for the court's reference these specific facts that the district court ignored and that the defendant ignores in their argument. Samusa is the entity that drafted the master consulting agreement and the later settlement agreement, both of which, it's our position, are enforceable, were not validly terminated for purposes of the New York RFP. To the extent there's any ambiguities under contra pro parentum, they should
be construed. Mr. McMahon, I understand that what Mr. Dannon said, if you go back to my real estate example, is that this termination was like a termination before the real estate is even put on the market. It's like signing a contract and the broker takes pictures and prepares a listing. But before the date the real estate is actually put on the market, the agreement is canceled. Now, what would Illinois or New York give to the broker under those circumstances?
I think both jurisdictions, Your Honor, would take a look at the facts. They'd have a factual inquiry and make a determination based on equity.
What case do you rely on for the proposition that in either Illinois or New York, under those circumstances, the broker gets anything?
We cited to a case in our brief that dealt in the context of commissions. The name of the case escapes me right now, Your Honor.
Was that a case where the cancellation was before the real estate was put on the market?
No, it was a commission case that dealt with. It
wasn't
a real estate case. It was a commission sales case before a deal closed.
Yeah. Mr. Dannon was arguing, and the question I just put to you is, suppose we're not dealing with a termination just before the deal closes. I know what the state law is on those cases. Suppose we're dealing with a termination after preparatory work has been done, but before the first bid is even made looking toward a deal. What do Illinois and New York law provide under those circumstances? That's the question I'm putting to you.
My understanding is that a court exercising its equitable powers would look to do what's fair, given the amount of work that...
And your understanding based on what case? And don't cite to me the cases involving termination the day before the deal closes.
I do not have a cite for Your Honor other than the cases that we cited in the brief, which I do not know off the top of my head. I'm going to refer the court to those cases. Whether it's New York or Illinois law, though, the issue is the court will take a look at the facts. And here I would remind the court that a primary aspect of my client's involvement in this whole deal was to raise the profile of this Spanish company with the people in New York who are the decision makers and to otherwise promote them and have them be a credible party to be invited to bid on the New York RFP. On the prior RFP issuance, they
actually, it sounded from your brief like the principal work for which you wanted a quantum merit recovery was sending a team over to Spain to lobby with the corporate parents to let their subsidiary bid. which is, one would think, a very different kind of activity than trying to get New York to accept a bid.
That was a significant activity, but we also cite the facts, Your Honor, that my clients retained registered lobbyists who dealt with the decision makers in New York to present Samusa as a credible party for the bid. And certainly the result is that they were awarded the bid, even though on the first go-around they were never even a player. So something different happened. It's our position, and we've alleged it, and for purposes of a motion to dismiss, the district court should have taken as true those well-pleaded facts that the our clients made a difference and added a value that allowed ultimately Samusa to be awarded this valuable contract. And if Samusa's taking the position that no enforceable contract existed, while reaping the benefits of my client's efforts under all concepts of equity, the court should take a look at all those facts, determine what is fair, and provide for compensation for my clients. I would note that there's no reference, again, to pre-RFP or that there's a termination of that March 25 letter agreement. And these are documents that Samusa drafted. So they're the ones taking the position that they've drafted the documents, they've received the benefits, but the documents aren't enforceable and there's no entitlement to payment. That cries out for the court to exercise its equity and do the right thing. And I would lastly point to the court, Mr. Dannon referenced a February 2004 conversation where there was an indication that just prior to, I think, the February 17th written communication terminating the MCA, there was a meeting that took place, Your Honors. And at that meeting, Samusa acknowledged that the master consulting agreement would apply and that applying the terms of the master consulting agreement, my clients were entitled to a $12 million payment. And they said, that's too much money. Under the agreements that we've all been operating under, you're going to get too much money. We can't have that. And what they did was they made a business decision. They asserted that they've terminated the contract. We believe they've breached after they've received the benefit. And it's either a breach of contract in which our clients are entitled to the damages, or it cries out for equitable relief. Or it cries out for the court to enforce the settlement agreement, where Samusa drafting the settlement agreement, valued the services at $1.7 to $2 million and then backed out of that deal after receiving additional services. It's a case that certainly should not be thrown out of court at the pleading stage. Given the standard applicable under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, the motion to dismiss should have been denied. And it's our position that our clients are entitled to their day in court. Mm-hmm. Your Honors, have no further questions. I will conclude.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court reminds counsel that memos on subject matter jurisdiction are due within 7 days. And when they're received, the case will be taken under advisement. The next